Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of Nature Now at kptz.org.
Hello, this is Deborah Kelso, host of this edition of Nature Now for the first week of August. This week, we are very pleased to have for you part two of a field recording that we did with ecologist Jeff Hammerson last month in the wetland area behind sound engineer Nora Petrich's house. Jeff is especially interested in amphibians, so we focused on sampling the pond for signs of amphibian use and had a lot of fun while we learned a lot. But before we get to our main topic, let's first hear the mystery sound of the week. A big hint for the sound is that you will often hear it in a wetland area. We'll play the call again at the end of the program and tell you what it is. Now on to part two of our wetland field trip. You'll find Nora, Jeff, and me immersed in looking at a second scoop of water from the pond.
I'm now leading Deborah and Jeff over towards the pond on our property that was dug at least 50 years ago for the purpose of a watering hole for a small herd of cattle. It is smaller, shallower, and a murkier body of water than the back pond that we had dug about 30 years ago. And it gets infestations of duckweed and mosquito ferns, which are floating aquatic plants. And another reason we call this a murky pond is because of the leeches I have seen on its shores.
Oh, yeah. I'm surprised that we haven't gotten one yet. It's more thrilling than I have. So I'm running the net across the bottom as much as I can, but very clogged with
vegetation,
duckweed.
So is duckweed an exotic? Or is it a native gone bad with extra nutrients?
I think the latter is a good description. Native, definitely native. Wow, this is super clogged. It's not even draining, hardly.
It's always a confusing thing. People go, oh, no, it's not a salamander, it's a newt. But newts are salamanders, right?
Right, newts are a type of salamander in the same way that a skink is a type of lizard or a yellowthroat is a type of warbler. They just happen to have that name newt for that group.
So Nora, as we're walking around to test the other side of the pond, I'm seeing nest boxes here.
Right.
What kind of nest boxes are these?
Yeah, so we have lots of violet greens and barn swallows. And we put these birdhouses out hoping they'd go away from the peaks of our home. But they still really prefer those upper peaks.
But they're taking care of your mosquito population.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
There's a tree frog calling.
I thought, I stopped to hear the tree frog and then I saw the yellowthroat, the male, in that tree there. Gosh, they're so lovely. So would we still be getting adults around the edges of these ponds, like red-legged frogs and...
Yeah, I think that if we had that sun out, the frogs will come up onto the shore and feed and take advantage of the warmth there, and animal life stirs to life with the heat too, and so they find plenty to eat and warm conditions.
Where would they be right now? Are they just hunkered down someplace in this vegetation? They're here, but they're just not vocalizing because it's not the breeding season, and they're not feeding because they're just resting.
All right, so red-legged frogs breed in the winter, really. We're well past the breeding season locally here for the tree frogs, but when they get back into the woods, even far, far from water, even way up in the trees sometimes, they'll call. And even through the fall, and then when it starts warming up again a little bit in the spring, they're way out in the forest still, but they're calling, and nobody really knows exactly what's going on, why they're doing that. there.
Well, we've commented on, Jeff lives close to where I do, out west of town, and you know, even in the wintertime, you'll hear them sounding forth.
Yeah, I'm wondering if they're like exercising their vocal apparatus so that when the real season starts, they're ready, they're properly warmed up and in tune.
That's right.
In order to catch something, we have to be like right on the bottom.
Okay.
So I'm going to try over here among the wetland plants that are sticking up.
These wetland plants, Jeff, are cattails, and is this burrweed? What is this?
Burrweed.
Burrweed.
A beautiful native wetland plant, and there's some spike brush here flowering. That's the name of the group. And the one with the prickly, spiny fruits on it, and it still has some flowers at the top of that one. Those are burrweed.
Yep.
Okay, we're back at the first pond, where we had good luck with finding tree frog larvae and newt larvae, and we're now on the other end. We'll see what we can get among the plants. Oh, it's deep there. I'm glad I didn't step off into that.
Wiggling bits. Oh, more salamanders, looks like.
Yeah.
They're right there.
Oh, that's a... Get the mayfly nymph. Let's get some water in there. Oops.
Boop. I see now.
Yeah, I can see the...
I needed my glasses.
Let me see if I can... It's just so beautiful out here, though. The flowering wetland plants. Came on the bottom, bringing the net into shore. Let's see, pull out some of the algae. Let's see what we got. Look at that. It's a big one. Check this out.
Wow. Oh, both sets of legs have developed.
Oh, yeah, look that we have here. Now, do you see how the shape of that snout is much broader? It's not tapered as much as on the other one?
Is it a northwest salamander?
And see how bushy the gills. If you look very carefully at the gills and get them submerged there, they're just lushly. It's like an ostrich plume almost. That's a northwestern salamander larva.
Cool. Well, we'll examine it more carefully when we get up to drier land. But I'm excited to compare the difference.
Here's another one.
Wow.
Let's see if it's the same. Yes. Awesome.
And their eggs are in a big mass, right? Don't they? It looks like almost a softball, a gelatinous mass where all the eggs are fused together?
Yes, that's right. All the eggs are in one clump, like you say, about a softball size.
But the rough-skinned newts, are they laid singly upon blades of vegetation?
It's totally different.
Yeah.
So the newt female lays her eggs one at a time, and she carefully attaches them to submerged plants. And it's hidden away in kind of a little spot on the plant that's not that visible. And she'll just scatter them around one after another. Whereas the northwestern salamanders, the female decides the spot. It's usually a submerged stem and lays a clump of dozens and dozens of eggs that might be as big as a softball by the time they swell up. You might wonder, how does a salamander that's an inch wide produce an egg mass that's 8 inches long and wide?
Well, I saw one years ago, and we didn't know what it was at that time. And I was like, whoa, what is that? There are a bunch of eggs that are massed together, right? If you look carefully, you see the dark centers.
What you may have seen are the tree frog egg masses.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. What you're describing, the size... But what we're talking about is something that big.
You mean an egg?
No,
it's a group of eggs all attached together and held together by jelly.
And hard jelly. I mean, it's almost
firm.
Rubberized.
You know, sometimes what happens is a female will be laying her eggs, and for whatever reason she's interrupted, and she'll just move off and finish off somewhere else. But what happens is when the gelatinous covering of the eggs hits the water, it starts absorbing water and expanding. Mm-hmm. So you can end up with a mass that's several inches wide, and of course the female herself is maybe an inch wide at most. So it's just the swelling that takes place after the eggs have laid.
So go back, Jeff, to what you were saying, that Nora might have seen a mass of tree frog eggs. Do tree frogs also lay them in a cluster?
Yes, clusters that are kind of small.
Like ping pong ball size
would be a good description for it. But within that mass, there would be, up to a few dozen eggs that would be suspended in the jelly.
The same as the Northwest same. Salamander, where the dark bits that you see scattered through the clear gelatinous mass are the egg itself.
Exactly the same idea. Oh, aren't those beautiful?
Oh, they
those.
Are. So for those of our radio audience that doesn't know the Northwest salamanders, they look way different from our newts. They can get quite large.
I mean, 10 inches long.
Yeah, and they look like something out of the Black Lagoon. I mean, they look a little scary. They're really dark, and they're usually more nocturnal, and you see them crossing the roads sometimes. Or in nests, they have... Would you tell us more, Jeff, about their burrows? I mean, they burrow sometimes several together, don't they?
All right, let's put them in their life history context. So they're done breeding, they come out of the water and go back up into the forest.
They won't stay in the pond.
No.
Uh-huh.
As much as you can say never in biology,
yeah,
there's always exceptions.
Right.
So basically, no, they leave. Once the breeding's done, they leave the water, move out into the forest, and live the rest of the year out in the forest floor. And they make use of already existing rotted out root channels or mole tunnels or rodent burrows, chipmunk burrows.
Or under, sometimes when people are moving their wood, they'll find...
Yeah,
this.
Any kind of cover,
yep,
for shelter and to, you know, those things retain moisture during the dry periods, and that kind of thing. So they'll spend a lot of the time there. And I found them where we live, under things a couple times, like moving heavy rocks or big clumps of wood, and oh, there it is. And
yep,
it's like, and there's no pond nearby anywhere.
But sometimes there'll be several of them, won't there?
I haven't discovered that myself, but I wouldn't doubt if there was a particularly favorable logs,
yeah,
or whatever.
Yep.
Yeah, sure.
They are large, and they're kind of almost a black shade, and they have really large eyes on the side, and you can also see their ribs, intercostal. Name.
They have, yeah, costal grooves.
That's right.
That have a 1-to-1 relationship with their vertebrae. So it's each side has these vertical grooves on it, left and right. And
you can see it really clearly. It looks skeletal if you're not used to that being as a diagnostic feature of the species. You're like, what?
And the thing that you can really see on the adults are the poison glands.
Oh.
On their neck and on their tail and on their back, they're loaded with poison glands. And so, like all amphibians, they have poison glands, and this particular species of the Northwestern salamander has a lot of them and concentrations of them. The poison is enough to protect them from certain kinds of predators. It's not as toxic as newt toxins are. Nevertheless, it's one of their defenses. And you can see them very prominently.
Is that really large bulb that you get?
Yeah, on their necks. They have lumps on, right behind the eyes on the neck, that are especially prominent. If a predator starts bothering them, they actually angle their head down and stick their neck upwards to make those poison glands more likely to be contacted by the attacking, let's say, bird or something, and get some of that poison into its bill, and it might say, I don't think I'm going to eat this one.
Uh-huh. Well, the same with the rough-skinned newts. They'll put themselves in that defensive posture where they arch their back and kind of curl up.
Yeah, right? It's a very, very distinctive behavior that they all do if they're attacked. Close their eyes, they curl their toes, they curl the tail up over their back, arch their head up and show off their bright orange color underneath that they have on the bottom side of the body. And that's usually enough to remind something that may have tried to eat one earlier how bad an experience it might be if it survived it.
But human beings are fine to move them off the road or handle them as long as we wash our hands up.
Yeah, there's no harm in touching a newt.
Yeah.
You just don't want to, touch your eyes right afterwards and just simply wash your hands. You're not going to be harmed by handling the newt.
No, or the Northwest.
Or Northwestern. None of these.
Salamanders, no.
No, you'd have to eat them.
Uh-huh. Which isn't
which most people don't really think about doing, and that's a good thing. Especially the newts are tremendous. Well, we have to say, though, now that the newts have been studied in detail, we know that not all newts are toxic to a deadly degree. Some of them have tons of it, of the toxin in their skin, and others have almost none.
Huh.
Yeah, it varies from population to population.
They found that the ones that are toxic are enough to protect the other ones.
Yeah, it's a complicated situation. Here in Washington, many of the newts are not very toxic.
Huh.
In other places, they're loaded with toxins. And so you try to explain that based on, for example, the existence of predators such as garter snakes, which have... in some species evolved a resistance to newt toxin, and they can eat them.
Huh. Oh, it's all a dance, isn't it? An evolutionary dance. Well, do you want to do another scoop?
I'll do one more scoop.
Okay, and then we'll come and look at these guys.
Yeah, get a photo. Or two.
Uh-oh. Well, we want to get the...
Here. Got another large larva here.
Cool.
There it is. Put it with the others. So they're pretty good size, but let's say the eggs were laid in perhaps February or March. Several months of growth there. And these will overwinter.
In the pond.
In the pond. It's possible for them to complete the life cycle in one season, but usually they overwinter. That's more common. So you can usually find these larvae in ponds at any time of the year. Well, we haven't found the red-legged frog, but hit or miss.
I wonder
if these are ones that have overwintered.
Yeah, I see what you mean, how blunt the nose on these guys is.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like the eyes are not as prominent.
Correct. They look more out to the sides, and on the newts they look more forward.
Uh-huh.
And the density of filaments on the gills is much higher on these Northwestern salamander larvae compared to the newt larvae.
And it looks like they've got sharper nails too. Is that right?
They don't have nails. They have sometimes darkened areas at the tip where there's more melanin, dark pigment, but no amphibian has true claws or nails. So what you're seeing may look nail-like, but in reality it's just
a darkened end.
Yeah, it's not.
But it seems like it tapers more than the other newts.
That's a good observation. They have really big gills, and that's true of all pond-dwelling salamanders, that the ones that live in still water, lakes, ponds, have very big bushy gills, whereas we have other salamanders that live, let's say, up in the mountains here, that torrent salamanders that live in fast-flowing cold water, and their gills are very, very small. In fact, sometimes it's hard to even see that they have gills. Just because of the oxygen content in that cold, rushing water is much higher than in a warmer pond. The oxygen level is less, and so they need bigger structures to extract the oxygen from the water.
Yeah, that makes sense. So what happens with all the others? I mean, we've got tons of salamanders in our area that are more woodland, that live under logs. Do they need water and reproduce?
Around here, the most common salamander that fits that description of living on land all throughout the year is the Encetina. As you get into the Olympics more, there are some other species, but you're right, they don't require water at all. In fact, they've evolved the ability to lay their jelly-covered eggs on land.
Wow.
And the female stays with them until they hatch, and she guards them. And she'll lay them in a moist spot under a rotting log or somewhere like that where things are going to not dry out. She'll stay with them a couple months, and then they'll hatch right into land-dwelling little larvae. Not larvae, but little salamanders. So the Encetina is a type of salamander, uh-huh. And it's a type that lives all throughout its life on land and doesn't require water at all. Whereas these ones that we've been catching in the ponds here absolutely have to have water. They don't have any option. It's funny, you put an Encetina, the land-dwelling species, into the water and you'll kill it.
Wow.
They're so tied now to the land as their essential habitat that they can't even live in water. You basically drown them if you put them in water.
Well, we'll have to do another field trip where we go on land and look for some of the woodland species.
Yeah, that'd be fun.
Well, thank you so much for coming to share this field trip with us, and we'll hope it's the start of many field trips that we will do with you and other great naturalists in our area. So thank you so much.
And thank you, Nora, for letting me wade in your pond. There's nothing more fun.
And here's our mystery sound again. It's a common yellowthroat, and I chose it as the mystery sound because we had such a lovely view of a pair of these birds while visiting Nora's ponds, but we didn't get a very good recording of their calls. They are often first detected by sound, as they are sometimes hard to see in the dense vegetation surrounding a wetland. The common yellowthroat is a kind of warbler. The male is stunning, with a wide black mask with a white border at the top and a bright yellow throat that extends into its breast. The female lacks the facial markings but has the same yellow throat and under tail coverts as the male. The juvenile looks like the female, but without the yellow throat, although the juvenile male shows a faint blackish mask. Common yellowthroats are often found in lower wetlands throughout western Washington from early April to late September. Throughout much of North America, they are typical inhabitants of cattail marshes and other wetlands with dense low growth. Though in western Washington, they are not as closely tied to cattail marshes as in other parts of their range. Although the destruction of wetlands has eliminated habitat in many areas, common yellowthroats are one of the most widely distributed and common warblers in North America, and populations in the Pacific Northwest have actually increased in recent years. Some populations are non-migratory, though Washington's breeders leave the state in winter for Mexico and Central America. So head out soon to one of your favorite wetlands to enjoy the sight of them for another month or two before they head south for the winter. Our thanks to the great website, birdweb.org, put together by Seattle Audubon, for the sound recording and additional information. And that's it for KPTC's Nature Now for the first week of August. Thanks very much to Jeff and Nora for doing the field recording with me, and to all of you for listening. This program will be rebroadcast at 5 p.m. on Thursday, 12:30 on Saturday, and available as a podcast in a week or so on kptz.org. If you would like to hear the first part of our field trip, please go to the podcast and search for part one of the show titled Wetland Field Trip. Closing music is Wade in the Water by Sweet Honey in the Rock. As always, happy trails.
See the kingdom, the Israelites
gonna be troubled.
Well, now you wanna wait in the water,
wait in the water,
wait in the water, children,
wait on me,
wait in the water,
until
God's gonna trouble the water. See those children dressed in black.
God's gonna trouble the water.
Well, you know, they come a long way, they ain't turning back.
God's gonna trouble
the water.
See the children, they're dressed up in blue. You know my God's gonna trouble the water. I say it looks like my people, they're coming on through. Well, my God's gonna trouble the water.
Well, everybody knows
wait the water.
Wait in the water.
Trouble, the water.